Heights. You guys want to start? Or do you want to wait for Steve?
I think he'll catch up.
Okay.
All right.
It's only 2:15.
Yeah, it's only 2:15?
2:15.
Oh, yeah. We are a little early.
I think we could wait.
I could wait.
Well, that's a good salad.
All right. So here we're going to talk about the next round of biannual code amendments. So I'm not sure if all of you have been through a round of these yet, but basically once in a while county rounds up some relatively small code changes and groups them all together. And basically these are changes intended to maintain the code and correct errors and provide clarifications, updates, and things like that. So today we're going to talk about 16 main items that we started in the fall. And so I'm going to start out in the this document here. Well, let's move on to it on the screen, which actually has the text of the proposal. So first one is basically a Scrivener error, and this is in the marijuana special uses section. It's a proposal to amend the reference to reflect the correct RCW and indicate the sign of signs in square inches instead of square feet in order to be consistent with the RCW. So the marijuana code signs reference the wrong RCW, and so this is just a fix to make it consistent with the RCW. So pretty self-explanatory, I think.
It is pretty funny that they would go a square inch or so for a sign, for an exterior sign.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And the way it is now, it's slightly larger than the 1,600 square inches. So we're blatantly violating the RCW, apparently. Yeah. All right, number two is updating the county's definition of solid waste. Back in the 90s, the RCW 304 was replaced by, I'm sorry, WAC, WAC, 304 was replaced by 350. So the old reference only applies to old landfills that were closed a long time ago. And so somebody in public health noticed that we had a extinct reference to the WAC. So this has been vetted with public health staff, so they're all on board with it and shouldn't cause any problems that we're aware of. Number three is a revision to a alley diagram that's included in the narrow lot standards. So the figure that's referenced cites an outdated standard details manual drawing. Standard details manual is drawings, you know, specific details that Public Works publishes and developers use. Those can change without amending the code. And as time has gone by, the drawing number 19 that this is intended to reference, that drawing 19 has changed to 17. So we're just going to get rid of any number at all, not just reference the urban alley drawing in the standard details manual. So, and then we're also clarifying that only the structural pavement sections have to meet the minimum requirements of an urban alley drawing. The urban alley drawing in the standard details manual is generally for a 20-foot wide alley. So the narrow lot standards have special provisions for really tight lots. So that's why this is even in there, because it allows a narrower profile. But the reference is to keep the pavement thickness as noted in the standard details alley cross-section. And if you ever, if any of you have questions, just pipe up and I'll slow down. Number four is to amend the sign code section to refer to other sign standards, such as appear in the Highway 99 the marijuana special use section and the mixed use code sections. So Highway 99 has its own special code. There are sign standards also in the marijuana code that we already discussed. And the mixed use standards also have different sign standards. So with the addition of the new marijuana code, it was kind of time to update the main Title 40 sign code to reference that, you know, besides the ones mentioned in Section 4310, there are also other places to look for other sign requirements. Number five, this is in the development approvals timeline section. Remove an outdated reference that states that the hearings examiner conducts hearing for developer agreements. In the fall of last year, a new code section was added regarding development agreement procedures. And in that section, it gives the county council all the review authority for developer agreements. The old code mentions a hearings examiner would hold hearings and then the board would make the final decision, but that last sentence is now moot because the council does all of them, does all the reviews of the developer agreement. That's number six, this is in the section dealing with the release of concomitant rezone agreements. Delete another sentence that's become moot. Prior to the code change that designated the county council as the review and approval authority to remove concomitant rezone agreements, the hearing examiner approved covenant releases for sites that had been already developed. In the case where it was a site that had never been developed, then the board could release those agreements. But now that the board releases all the agreements, this, remaining sentence that's still there is now moot because, again, the council approves all rezoned agreements, whether the site's developed or not. Number seven is a proposal to amend Section 4200.070, which are the exceptions to setback requirements, to clarify what can and what can't project outside of a building or development envelope. Now, a development envelope or building envelope is something that's put on a plat to show where you can and you can't build. Now, pretty much all properties are subject to setbacks, whether they're platted or not. If you have a tax lot and you're in an R5 zone, you have to have 20-foot side setback, 50-foot front, et cetera. And when a project gets platted, when a land division gets platted, then oftentimes there'll be a development envelope that's put right on the plat that makes it clear, you know, what the setbacks are, if there's any easements on the property that you can't build in, and also critical areas are denoted basically kind of off limits. So when you look at all those different restrictions on a lot, that determines a development envelope. Now, every plat doesn't have a development envelope, but properties that are a little more complicated and have more critical areas and things like that, or if they have a really weird shape, it's hard sometimes to clearly always know what the setbacks are going to be. So we may, when we review it, we know, you know, what the front's going to be, what side's going to be. But then if it's not totally clear, the development envelopes can basically memorialize what those are, and that helps with the review of the property, you know, later on when you come in for building permits. So right now, development envelopes, this section, code section, that is exception to setback requirements, specifically notes that you cannot allow things like eaves, porches, all these things that are listed in Section A, you don't get to use them with development envelopes. And half the reason why development envelope is put on a plat is to reflect a setback. And so this section, again, this says what you can allow of your building to go into a setback. So there was, we had a blackboard that could just, you got the idea? So basically this section deals with if you've got a 5-foot setback on an urban lot, that setback is intended to show where your foundation line is supposed to go. Then your eaves can overhang into that setback. So typically it's 2 feet for an eave. And this section that we're amending talks about all those projections. You can have eaves can project 2 feet, porches of a certain height can project another area outside of it. But again, right now, section A7 right now says the above exceptions do not apply to development envelopes or landscape buffers. So again, half the reason these envelopes are put on a plat is when they reflect setbacks, you're supposed to be able to use these exceptions that are noted. So another complicating factor is that development envelope and building envelope is not actually defined in the code. And when we were working on this, we thought we would try to define those, and then we went to DEEB, and the definitions got convoluted and complicated pretty quickly. And so they had concerns that what we were trying to do was just as complicated and confusing as what we've got now. So since the DEEB meeting, we've just tried to simplify it. And on page 6, lines 24, starting on lines 24, so we're saying that the allowed projections noted above may not apply to landscape buffers. That's already in the code. Number 8 says that the allowed projections noted above apply to building and development envelopes except when limited by the following. When the envelope line reflects a critical area or easement, then we still do not want these eaves and porches intruding into a critical area. So we don't want that. But otherwise, if the envelope line is reflecting a setback, then there's no problem with that, and you should be able to use them. So basically, we're trying to make it clear when you can and cannot allow these projections to go outside of a building envelope, depending upon, you know, what, you know, how that line was determined and what the purpose of that envelope line was. Let's see. So any questions on that one? That one's probably the more...
I thought it did clear
the most common.
Your exceptions rather well.
Okay.
I've had that issue on project before.
Yeah, okay. Okay, good, because it has caused...
If it had been that clear...
It's caused a lot of grief, you know. So, grief for staff and developers as well.
I bet.
All right. Number 8 is to amend the narrow lot standard section to clarify that building envelopes should reflect building setbacks, not all projections. This is totally related to this last one we discussed, because the narrow lot standards currently... say that you're supposed to show building envelopes which encompass all projections. So instead, we're just going to say building envelope that reflect the final setbacks and leave it at that. So number 9 is a proposal to add the definition of garage sale. So right now we have a special use code section for garage sales, but we don't define what a garage sale is. And so enforcement staff requested that we add this because it can cause, you know, people fight over what they're doing, whether it's a garage sale or not. So, Susan, if you want to chime in and explain some background on why this definition is needed and how it'll help out.
Now it's on.
There we go.
Greetings, everybody. My name is Susan Anderson. I manage animal control and code enforcement for the county. And this is the one change that made it into this process from code enforcement. This request came from my longtime code enforcement coordinator, Kevin Pridemore, who has the task of justifying the notice and orders that we write for violations of Title 40 and nuisance code and things like that. And he has run into occasions where a person is selling things from their home and they may argue that this was not a garage sale because it was in my yard, or this is not a garage sale, this is an estate sale, something like that. So we're just trying to aid code enforcement and give us a more airtight tool, especially in the cases of appeal requests.
Does the code go on further to define, I didn't read the code, the duration of a garage sale?
It does. The current 40.260.090 does define sales lasting no longer than 3 days as a requirement of a garage sale.
Yeah. Makes sense.
Number 10, I'm on the bottom of page 7. In the Type 4 process section, which basically is the comp plan amendment section of the code, include the manner of making comments within the published notice requirements. So in other sections of the county code that deal with public notice requirements, the manner of making public comments on the proposal is included. So it gives the person reading the newspaper ad that says how you provide your written comments or however. In this section of code, it doesn't mention how you make public comments. And so we're simply adding that in this Type 4 process section, and it'll be consistent with the rest of the code and, you know, provide additional guidance for people who are commenting or reading about these comp plan amendments. Now we're into the minor policy items. We hope these are not too big. I don't think they are. Number 11 on page 8, the proposal is to amend chapters 14 and 15, which deal with building and fire codes, to remove separate references to separate building, plumbing, and fire boards of appeals. Instead, defer back to the provisions in the adopted national codes and how they handle appeals. So as it is now, the county, the sections, there's exceptions in the building code and exceptions in the fire code. Let me back up. Let me start over on this. Maybe I'll just, it's kind of a tricky thing. So I'm just going to read what I wrote because I was able to put my thoughts together. The Clark County building and fire codes mostly adopt national building and fire codes. And those parts of those national codes that the county has chosen to not adopt or otherwise customize are called out in certain sections of Titles 14 and 15. The particular Clark County Code sections that are proposed to be mostly removed are exceptions to the appeals provisions in the International Building Code, that's basically kind of the commercial building code, the IRC, which is the International Residential Code, and the International Mechanical Code, and the Plumbing Code, and the International Fire Code. So right now, we basically adopt most of those codes en masse, and then we have sections in building and fire code that say what we're not adopting. And so the parts, some of these parts that we're proposing to amend, they say we're not adopting the sections on appeals that the IBC and the IRC has. Instead, the current county code has these somewhat elaborate requirements for the makeup of these appeal boards. So there's three different appeal boards, you know, spread out in these code sections. And they all have these different requirements. Like one says, you know, you have an engineer, you have an architect with experience in X, Y, and Z. So there's, you know, essentially you've got 20 people called out, 20 specific people to serve on these appeal boards. And in effect, we haven't had these because it's been hard to find that many people with those kind of qualifications. So our code says that we have these specialty appeal boards made up, and we don't. And it's proven hard to generate, you know, to create a board like that and keep them going. So basically, by eliminating our exceptions, we're going to adopt the appeals processes in those national codes, which are generally pretty general. And it says, you know, the appeals board will be created. So by, you know, deferring back to what's stated in the national codes, we don't have to have a particular makeup of those groups, of those appeal boards. So the intention is to be able to, you know, have one board. That's the idea, is to have one board that deals with plumbing, electrical, not electrical, we don't do electrical, but plumbing, building, and fire. And that's what our intention is to do. Dan, do you have anything that you wanted to add to that? Okay.
So who's going to make up that board? It's going to be a general board that hears all regardless?
So yeah, the intent is just to have one board, which will have members of the community at that will look at alternate methods and stuff like that. But as Jan said, right now you have to have 20-some different people. Now we'll have seven with a wide variety. They'll be able to interpret or help interpret the code for appeals. So it should be more streamlined. And we should be able to get seven people as opposed to trying to get 20-some people volunteering their time. So,
what do we do currently?
Right now, we haven't had the boards meet in over 20 years.
So we haven't had any appeals in 20 years?
No. Not that people have wanted to go that far. Is it, you're kind of in a catch, you know, circular thing. Did they not appeal because we didn't have the board, or did we not have appeals? You know, so we definitely need to have the appeals board have a meet and then have that option open.
So if they're not seeing appeals, what do they do?
Typically, it's handled by the building official, the fire marshal, in-house. But up until this point, if there's been a reason for it, they've either been able to work it out or people just think that they don't have a way to go.
No, I mean, when we get this seven people put together, if there's no appeals, what do they do?
Well, there will be appeals. So the IBC and the IRC do allow for appeals. And so by us getting rid of these exceptions, we're going to be adopting those code sections. And they should be part of your packet. I included the sections of the IBC and the IRC that talk about the appeals process of those codes allow.
So we think because we're going to make the process simpler, more people are going to file appeals.
It's not simpler.
Well,
it will exist.
It will exist. Sorry. I don't want to say simpler, but it will exist.
Yeah, there's nothing right now.
So we think once it's there, people will
actually. Once they're there, then hopefully, you know, if we're having those major discussions about differences, then they have a place to go.
Okay.
You know, and they are an advisory board. They do not make code. It's just interpret if the building official or the fire marshal or the plumbing official has used their discretion wisely, basically, you know, for interpretations of. Typically what you're going to see is alternate means and methods. So when new materials come forth, whether or not they meet the intent of the code. So you'll have just not just one person being the building official. You'll have other professionals look at it too to determine whether or not it meets the intent of the code. So it's just not one person making that decision.
And who will appoint the board?
We will actually go through a process of like a job interview, really. We post it and they say whether they want to or not. And then I think I, as the director, will get to choose the board. So the fire.
For you then.
Yeah. Yeah. So the building official and the fire marshal will not be picking them. It'll be myself, and you'll be looking for, you know, the wide variety. So you're not having seven architects or seven engineers. You want to have a variety of, you know, people on the board to get a better, you know, more experience, depth of knowledge.
And do you already have a feel for what the makeup of that board would look like then?
Yeah, we do. Like I said, you know, have an engineer, a couple different engineers, because being a fire and a plumbing and a building, you know, ideally we would have, and it's hard to get them, that's why I say ideally we'd have a fire protection engineer, a structural engineer, and a mechanical engineer, and then like an architect, a contractor, and somebody just from the general public. But because of the specific needs, sometimes it's hard to get somebody that will volunteer their time.
Those particular disciplines.
Those disciplines. So that way we're not pigeonholed. We can, you know, actually have an appeals board that will work, as opposed to trying to find a square peg for a round hole that has to meet that. And that's what the intent of this is to allow flexibility.
Okay. So, Jan, I think for the record, when we go in, I'd like to see a state that the board is to be appointed by the director here, and we have a general idea of what disciplines we'd like to see in it.
Actually, we need to take a look at the county charter before we do that, because it may be that this board must be appointed by the county manager. And if it's not appointed by the county manager, the general boards are appointed by the council. But more are appointed by the county manager.
Okay, and I'm fine with that. I think it's just worth having the public understand clearly at what level the appointments come from and how the choice of what disciplines are beyond the board are made.
Yeah.
You might look at 108.1, and this is not a section that's marked not adopted, because it seems to say that they'll be appointed by the governing body. That's on page 13 of the attachment, section 108.1.
So that would be the county manager.
So it would be the governing body that would appoint. I think governing body means the board of councilors.
Yeah, that's the council.
Yeah.
So if you want someone else to appoint it, you probably need to not adopt that provision and write your own or whatever.
Have we adopted that provision, Steve, are you saying?
I don't know. It's part of the attachment, and the attachment has certain provisions that say not adopted, and this one is not one of the ones that says not adopted. So it looks like that's one of the ones being adopted.
Then that's the council.
But I haven't studied this in detail. I'm just coming to
So you. One of the things that we
just
definitely
pointing
don't...
Just that out, as you're looking into that issue, you want to look at that.
Yeah.
But
that UDC
page,
section.
Yeah, but 15. Page 13 that you point out is the International Fire Code.
Which is what we're saying that we're going to, though.
Right.
Yeah, the fire, the building will all be
adopted. Right, but they're saying they're adopting the International Fire Code to replace...
along with the IBC
Well, but they're specifically not adopting certain provisions of the IBC, because further, there's some other provisions here on page 8 that talk about the qualifications and the membership and blah, 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 but then it says these are not adopted.
Yeah, and what we don't want is, like I said...
You don't want to adopt those, but this one here on section 13 doesn't say not adopted, so it looks like that is one that is being adopted.
We'll make sure that's clear, but we just don't want to adopt the other part and pigeonhole us and say we're going to have a structural engineer when we can't get one, but you can get a mechanical engineer on there. You know, we want to have that flexibility, that we're not pigeonholed by a certain discipline that we may or may not be able to get. We posted for it about 6 to 9 months ago, and we did not get enough people to fill the board.
Probably hard to get people excited about joining a board that rarely gets to do anything.
Yeah, so this will help us by.
Yeah. Okay.
I've been on the City of Vancouver Building and Fire Board, and we hear appeals, and we've had one in 15 years in terms of appeals.
Yeah, they're not that common.
The vast majority of them are worked out long before they get to that point. So I can see why the board just hasn't been active.
So I'm sorry, I shouldn't interrupt.
Yeah, no.
But so doubling back, are you asking for code language that says how this would be, or just more background on how this process would work? I wasn't clear on that.
Well, specifically, since Steve has pointed out that there's adoptable language in here, I think we need to be pointing to specifically what language we're asking to adopt that would then say that is indeed how the board will be created. What I'm trying to avoid is the idea of us passing something around and people still not having an idea before it goes to the council of, well, who picks the board and what disciplines are on the board. And I think the concept of saying ideally we'd like to have these disciplines, but it's going to be a 7-member board is adequate. But the idea of who is the final say on who is picking, I think we should have our ducks in a row on that. If it's the council, it's the council. If it's the city manager or the county manager, so be it.
I think you're right on that. That needs just a little bit of clarification, so we can work on that.
All right. I guess if we're done with that one, we'll move on. Number 12, in the urban accessory dwelling unit provisions, remove the R110 and R120 zoning requirements in order to allow larger size ADUs on larger lots, regardless of zoning. So right now, urban ADUs are limited to 800 square feet or 40% of the main dwelling area, whichever is less. However, right now, in certain zoning, in the R110 zone and in the R120 zone, if your lot is at least, let's just talk about the R110 for now. R110 requires 10,000 square foot lots generally. So right now, if you have a primary dwelling on an R110 lot that is indeed 10,000 square feet or more, and you have a large house, your ADU can not be limited to 800 square feet. It can be limited, or it's limited to 1,000 square feet, assuming you have enough. I'm not explaining this very well. Okay, so you got an R110 lot. You got a big honking house. You've got 5,000 square foot house on this R110 lot. Typically, if you're in the R16 zone or R15, the maximum size you can go for an ADU is 800 square feet, no matter what the house size is. But if you're on these larger lots right now, if you're in the R110 zone and you've got a 10,000 square foot lot and you've got a big house, you can get up to 1,000 square feet for an ADU. You're not limited to 800. That's provided you have a house that is
4,000 square feet.
5,000 square feet, 5,000, let's see, 5,000 times. No, it wouldn't be that much. I should actually come up with better examples. Anyway, right now, the idea is to get rid of the zoning requirement. The idea is if you've got a 10,000 square foot lot, whether you're zoned R15, R16, R175, or R110, if you've got a 10,000 square foot lot and you've got a big house on it, then you should be able to go up to 1,000 square feet for an ADU because you got a big lot. So what does the zoning really have to matter? You know, what it's own. Got a big lot, got a big house. It's all kind of proportional to the lot size. So that's the proposal to get rid of the R110, R120 zoning requirement and just look at it like how big is your lot. If your lot's 10,000 square feet and your house is big enough, such that you're not exceeding 40% with the ADU, you should be able to go up to 1,000 square feet. It's not a huge difference as it is, 800 to 1,000 square feet. And if you're in a, if you have a 20,000 square foot lot, a maximum ADU size would be 1,500 square feet, provided you've got, you know, a big house to start with. So.
So what drove this policy change?
Demand, really. People want larger ADUs, and they don't understand why the zoning has anything to do with it. You got a large lot.
So they're on a smaller than an R110 by zoning, but they have a large lot, and they want to put an ADU on it.
Right.
A larger ADU.
Larger than 800 square feet.
Right. Right now, they're limited by zoning. If they don't have the right zoning, then they're not allowed to do it.
Demand, huh?
Okay. All right. Number 13. We're back to the narrow lot standards. And we're talking about alleys again. So in the narrow lot standards require that alleys that are less than 20 feet wide must be private, not public. So I was talking about the detail for that narrow lot alley section. So sometimes we have seen some of these narrower alleys. And so it's been found that if you have an alley that's only 16 feet wide, it's kind of hard to maintain it. It's harder to repave it. If you have to plow it, it's harder to do. So the proposal is that if you're going to use these narrow alley sections, that they would have to be privately owned and privately maintained. So also we're cleaning up in this section that right now the code says where provided, alley shall meet the, we're proposing to say the minimum dimensional requirements in figure 40, 260, 155. And then also it goes on to say a minimum of 24 feet of clear area unobstructed by fences, and we're adding other structures. So if you've got an alley, basically your alley may only need to be 16 feet wide of pavement, but there's supposed to be 24 feet of width between like one garage on one side and a garage on the other side. So we want to have 24 feet of clear area so you can actually maneuver and get your car into the garage. So right now the code only says that the 24 feet is supposed to be unobstructed by fences, but there could be other structures too that somebody might want to put in there. And then also we're going to clean up the fact that the vertical clearance needs to be maintained. So in other words, you can't have an overhang that's going to be lower than 13.5 feet that's going to encroach into that clear area. So that's what we're proposing to do.
So the overhang can go inside the 24-foot width?
No, the overhang would have to stay out of the 24-foot clear area as well.
And what difference does it make?
Well, if it's 14 feet,
if it's a two-story building.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Let's see. I'm sure.
13 and a half.
Yeah.
So if you extend into it.
Yeah, as long as it's high enough.
As long as you have 13 and a half feet of clearance.
Yeah.
Okay, so it will extend into the 24. Mm-hmm.
But not below
13
and a half.
Right.
I understand.
Right.
All right. Makes sense. You can get a taller vehicle down the alley if you had to, or a fire truck down the alley if you had to, without hitting the structures.
Right.
13 and a half feet.
And that's standard fire code. Number 14 are revisions to the critical aquifer recharge code sections. Basically, this section of code deals with protecting groundwater supplies. And unfortunately, we don't have anybody from Public Works to provide technical backup on this, but the Development and Engineering Advisory Board and County Engineering staff had a subcommittee that worked on revisions to these CARA code requirements. I guess they've been in effect, been in place since the 90s. And since the CARA code was developed, the stormwater code has gotten better and better. And, well, more restrictive, depends on what side of the game you're on. Anyway, the stormwater code's gotten more restrictive and, you know, it has more protections in place to protect groundwater in and of itself. So this section on CARA was established in the 90s, never really touched, so it's kind of become antiquated. And engineering, the development community has had some gripes about this code for a long time. So the DEEB and county staff worked together, developed a subcommittee, and over the course of several months kind of hashed out these changes. And, you know, the idea is that they're going to get rid of stuff that they don't need and try to make some of this clearer. In the main sections, the biggest improvement to this is that it would eliminate the need for a CARA permit for stormwater infiltration facilities. Because right now the code, CARA code talks about class 5 injection wells, and that sounds like a really serious thing. But a class 5 injection well can simply be an infiltration swale. So you don't have to necessarily be injecting anything. It just can infiltrate all by itself. So stormwater code has requirements that, you know, for pretreatment and all that kind of stuff already. So requiring a CARA code is just paperwork and extra expense that isn't really accomplishing anything, because the stormwater code's already getting us to the same point. So so they propose to get rid of the typical infiltration, when you're doing typical infiltration, to have to get a CARA permit. Now, other more serious types of injection systems still would need a CARA permit, but the regular infiltration for stormwater would not. So that's one of the big changes. The other change is to remove the requirement for quarterly monitoring reports for level 2 site evaluations. Again, with all the upgrades to the stormwater code and, you know, with limited resources available, right now these level 2 evaluations require a plan for, you know, quarterly monitoring. And, you know, one, it's an expensive thing for somebody to have to do. And two, we don't charge a fee for that, you know, for those types of monitoring, for the, provide staff to be looking at these reports. And so basically, even though the code says you're supposed to be doing it, I understand that it's really not been happening. And, you know, it's really not a big deal. So seems to be little, if any, benefit to that requirement. And at the hearing, you know, we'll have engineering staff and possibly some of the members of the DEEB that helped evaluate. They may be able to shed some light on some of the issues if you have further questions at the hearing. Number 15 is a proposal to amend Section 4540.120, Alteration and Vacation of Final Plats. This is to allow for a minor plat alteration process. So once you have a plat, you're sort of locked into what it says. And if you want to do something that the plat says you can't, or, you know, move a line, you have to go through a plat alteration. And I think Mr. Marash is well, you know, acquainted with this requirement. So as it is, you know, it's a two-stage process. First, you go through preliminary. First, there's a pre-app requirement, generally, and then there is a preliminary approval process, 78 days. where we notify the neighbors and, you know, look at whether this amendment is, you know, whether we should do it or not. And the third process is typically filing a plat alteration declaration. Basically, it's a formal legal declaration, for lack of a better word, that says we are hereby amending the plat the following ways, and then a diagram comes with it, shows the old plat, you know, with the feature that's proposed to be moved, amended or removed, and then the diagram that shows what the new plat would look like. So anyway, it's a involved process, and there are some times that plat alterations are needed to fix really simple things, Scrivener's errors, something that got put on the plat that really wasn't intended, that the preliminary review never anticipated, or is clearly at odds with what the preliminary review, you know, would have wanted or intended. But right now, those plat alterations have to go through this involved process. So we're proposing to add a new category for a minor plat alteration, and that would be on page 22 of the attachment A. Line 25 says, minor plat alterations may be processed with reduced submittal requirements as determined by the responsible official. Criteria of what constitutes a minor plat alteration are as follows. The alteration consists of correcting a Scrivener's errors, which is clearly inconsistent with the intent of the preliminary review, and the judgment of the responsible official does not affect the public interest. Second category would be that the alteration would provide consistency with current code requirements, and again, in the judgment of the responsible official, does not affect the public interest. So these would be quicker, easier, you know, a plat. We still have to go through the public notice process because the RCW requires that. If you're changing a plat, your neighbors should need to know. Most of the time, you know, it's not going to matter to them, but we still do have to do that. Years ago, we checked with legal staff to see if we could avoid that step, and we can't. But at least with these no-brainer type of plat alts, the idea is that you'd submit less stuff up front. You wouldn't have to have a pre-app because it's pretty simple, pretty obvious what we need to do. And then there'd be one process. They submit the application one time. They would have everything they need for preliminary review and the final declaration review at the same time. And we would be able to get it done faster and cheaper. Also within this section, we're changing the notice requirement back on page 19, line 28 and 29. Whoops, I'm sorry, wrong line. Again, page 19, lines 33. Right now, when this goes out for public notice, the notice states that anybody has within 21 days to request a public hearing on it, and the RCW doesn't require 21 days, it only requires 14. And so we're proposing to change it.
You got 15 in parentheses.
Right. Yeah. Well, we want to do 15 because that's what all our other notices.
Then it should say 15 in text.
Oh.
It says 14.
Oh, yeah, I see 15. What you mean.
Okay. Those two should be the same.
Yeah. Sorry about that. Okay. I don't have a very good proofreader.
Scrivener error. Is that what we're talking
about? Yeah. Got to keep the process going, you know, keep this tradition going. Thanks for noticing that. So anyway, all other notices, people get 15 days to comment so that their comments can be in the record. So making it 15, one more day extra than the RCW.
We'll make it
14.
We
won't make 15.
So even under the concept that it's a minor alteration based on the criteria, public noticing remains the same.
Yes. Yeah. So even if, you know, so we think it's a no-brainer, a neighbor might disagree, you know, and they may say, no, it's not a no-brainer. This is going to affect me in some way that we're not even anticipating. So if that's the case, then somebody could still request a public hearing or, you know, provide input, certainly, to it, to the whole situation. You know, if
when we go through the hearing process, will you start with the notification amendment? And then let's just say clearly that under all circumstances, this is the notification process.
Oh, you mean just in the explanation? Just
right up front, right?
Okay.
And then when we get into the minor part,
okay,
we won't have to discuss whether it's different or the same.
Okay. All right. Do that. All right, so yeah, we're hoping this will provide relief because, like I say, sometimes we understand that these things are really minor, but we still have to go through the process. And, you know, frankly, sometimes some things that do seem minor on its face, you know, they can, get rather convoluted. But, you know, but for clearly things that are, you know, clearly no-brainers, we want to do make it easier for
any
people.
Any idea what our lead time is for the process currently?
Right now, standard flat alt, the preliminary review period is 78 days. Now, you know, we have processed them quicker than that because there have been situations already that we recognize that this isn't a big deal. So we have gotten them done sooner, but we're looking to put it in code. And the code doesn't say when we will get them done, but that would be a process, a process requirement or a internal process that we would do.
It seems like that's where our internal effort is going to yield the lower cost, the quicker turnover kind of thought.
Yeah, we are going to put a new fee in the code in the table. You guys don't review fees, but we're looking at just charging them what the declaration fee is now, plus a notice fee. So it's like $1,600-$1,700 for the one-step process.
But you eliminate the pre-app process, which
right.
is another whole application process and waiting period.
Right. Yeah.
That's a great step forward.
Yeah. Okay. I just want us to be able to kind of toot our own horn on that and make sure everybody clearly understands it's not just in here, but we're actually making something that on the ground floor for the people coming in, they should notice an improvement as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Do we want to put the word or between 3A and B just to make it clear that these are two separate categories? You don't have to meet both criteria.
Okay.
I'm worried the way it's worded right now, the legal counsel might look at that someday in the future and say, oh, it looks to me like it's both. You have to both be a Scrivener's error and meet
okay.
number two.
All right. Yeah.
If those are separate categories, I'd like
yes.
to be clear that they're separate.
Yeah. Right. Number 16, this is a proposal to amend part of the Highway 99 code, basically to allow commercial uses on a few select residentially zoned parcels that are within activity centers. So in the Highway 99 code, you've got these sub areas. These nodes of activity, they're called activity centers. And the intent of an activity center in the sub area plan, the Highway 99 sub area plan, is to emphasize uses and design that attract pedestrian activities. Now, all but five parcels that are in activity centers are zoned commercial, either community commercial or general commercial. The idea is that that was the intent, that everything in an activity center would allow commercial uses. And so it's not clear whether it was, I think it was an oversight when the Highway 99 code was being developed. And in fact, in the Highway 99 section and activity centers, there's a map, and these five parcels that are residentially zoned are actually shown as commercially zoned. So rather than have these five individual residentially zoned parcels have to go through a comp plan amendment to go get changed to commercial, the quicker way to do it is just to amend the Highway 99 activity center section to allow all uses allowed in the community commercial zone. So that would take care of it quick and easy. There's only five parcels and a portion of another one in a different activity center. So going to make it easier.
And the long list from line 37 down is all conditional use?
Yeah, I just left that. We're not touching that at all.
Just for context.
Yeah. Only thing we're changing would be...
Some of them are pretty scary for Highway 99.
Yeah, well, they still do... This list 37 through 42, they're pretty intensive, yeah.
Yeah,
like we're going to get a stadium. You never know.
Zoo? With a distribution facility of 25,000 square feet.
There's a few zoos already.
At the zoo. Yeah.
Have you driven through some of the trailer courts down there?
Okay. No, that's prohibited.
Yeah, those last
25,
items.
Those last items, addition use is prohibited. It's hard to see because it's not indented very well.
Yeah.
Oh.
The conditional uses are the event facilities and the outdoor paintball facilities, the stadium and the hospitals, and drive-in theaters. I don't know if anybody's building any drive-in theaters anymore.
I don't know how you review those for Highway 99 standards.
Yeah. Zoos. Yeah, we should get a zoo.
Yeah. All right.
I want to see the outdoor paintball facility.
Questions on any of this? All right. Okay, then. Thanks for showing up. You know, the scheduling was kind of tight to get you guys together. Appreciate you showing up over the holiday period.
Yeah. Holidays are over. Tell me about work.
Yeah. That's right. We're over
yet. We're still in holiday mode, but we're working. Yeah. Holiday mode.
All right. We'll see you in a couple
always
weeks.
Holiday
all
right.
What
are you
talking about? It's going to be strange going back for me. I got